from across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
Welcome to the Named Lecture Series on the Aero Society Channel, brought to you by the Royal Aeronautical Society in association with IPA Media. For the usage policy of this and all other content on the Aero Society Channel, please review the terms and conditions at aerosocietychannel.com.
Fellow DGs, trustees, ladies and gentlemen, as Chairman of the Board of Trustees for the Stuart Memorial Trust and DGMS RAF, and on behalf of Ladies Matthews, who sadly cannot be with us here this evening, and Callum Stewart, welcome you to the 2010 Stuart Memorial Lecture. Before I move on to say a few words about Air Vice Marshal William Stewart and this evening's speaker, Sally Evans, can I offer the Trust's appreciation to the Royal Aeronautical Society and Martin Baker Aircraft Company Limited for their continuing support of the Stuart Memorial Lecture. Sally and I have spoken already, and I know that she will refer to the life and works of Air Vice Marshal William Stewart, but I would like to take this opportunity to reinforce the significance of his life's work and hence the importance of this lecture. It's no exaggeration to say that the early death of Air Vice Marshal Stewart at the age of 53,
you're listening to the
medical
main
services
lecture
lost one of its most illustrious
officers.
The Royal
Aeronautical Society.
The catalogue of his scientific and personal achievements
we hope you are
is too
enjoying
long
the presentation.
To list. But it is safe to say he was a remarkable scientist who conducted his work with both courage and adventure. He dedicated his career to the study of the physiology of flight, to challenge the raft of limitations in order to advance the science of aviation medicine and ultimately to ensure the safety of aviators. Of equal importance was his charm and strength of character, and he was regarded by many as both a friend and a counsel. Air Vice Marshal William Stewart's many contributions to the science of aviation medicine continue to influence to this day and will do so for many years to come. And now to our speaker. Dr. Sally Evans worked as a general practitioner and for British Airways before joining the UK Civil Aviation Authority in 1993. She was appointed their chief medical officer in August 2005. She has and continues to have a significant role in aviation medicine. Amongst her many areas of expertise and influence are having been the UK representative on the Joint Aviation Authority's medical subgroup and the chairman of EASA's medical subgroup that drafted Class 1 and Class 2 medical recommendations. She is the medical representative on EASA's Flight Crew Licensing Core Group and is a member of the International Civil Aviation Organization's Medical Provisions Study Group. Furthermore, she is deputy chief examiner for the UK Diploma in Aviation Medicine and is currently chairman of the European Aviation Authority's Chief Medical Officers Forum. She also has held in a PPL. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm delighted to introduce Dr. Sally Evans.
Good evening, everyone. I'd very much like to thank the Chair of the Stuart Trustees, Vice Marshal Chris Morris, the Stuart Trustees, and the Chair of the Aerospace Medicine Committee of the Royal Aeronautical Society, Wing Commander Nick Green, for inviting me to speak to you this evening. As you know, the lecture is dedicated to the memory of Air Vice Marshal William Stuart. Now, Air Vice Marshal William Stuart was he was a student in Cambridge immediately before the last World War. He joined the RAF Voluntary Reserve, and he was then called up and posted to a balloon unit in Northumberland. There he was found by Brian Matthews and brought down to Farnborough, from whence he led the acceleration research programme, and that continued during the war. He was the first head of the Institute of Aviation Medicine from 1946 through to his untimely death in 1967. Now, I was speaking with Frank Marshall at the AME conference on Saturday, and Frank told me that his most vivid memory of Bill Stewart was of him covered with blood, having bailed out of a Spitfire in a wind tunnel at Farnborough and landing on concrete. So those were the days before health and safety got in the way, very definitely. So this was the centrifuge that Bill Stewart would have known. And with this was the centrifuge that I had a few runs in at Farnborough during my diploma course in 1995. Can you spot the difference? It is the same centrifuge. The bit that was added was the little cabin at the front here. So thank you very much, Nick, for providing those photos to me. Now, amongst this audience, quite a few of you will have had a few runs on the centrifuge. Can I just have a show of hands as to how many of you have been on the centrifuge? That's a fair number. That's a fair number. Okay. So there are a few that haven't, and there are a couple of points about the centrifuge that you need to know. To go on the centrifuge and to achieve the high G, you need to learn the anti-G straining manoeuvre. Now, this was taught to me during my diploma course, and hopefully the recent diploma course are well-versed in this and will remember it. From very recent memory, I understand. And it's quite a noisy manoeuvre to perform. Now, many of you will know Mark Lewis, and Mark Lewis was in control of my centrifuge runs. His description of me was sounding like a hippopotamus in labour. Most ungentlemanly, I think. The other point about the centrifuge is that it has effects on your facial features. It distorts the way that you look. And it makes you age by about 30 years. I've got a little video of me at home, which I didn't put onto the presentation. But I was given a video by Mark Lewis after my centrifuge runs, and I took it home to my children. Their description of me was that I turned into a witch. So these are the type of facial distortions that you see. These pictures are all off YouTube. They're USAF pictures. So if any of the recent students have got pictures to upload, please put them on. Can have the most amazing effects. So I kind of wish I was a witch for this lecture, because I need a crystal ball. Talking about Europe and medical rules being developed within Europe is a bit of crystal ball gazing at the moment, as the rules are work in progress. We haven't achieved the final text, so I can't tell you any detail of the medical requirements that are to come. I called the lecture Untangling the Web, and that's because it's a very, very complex process. European legislation is really quite complicated. And also, just when you think you've got somewhere and you've built up a big structure, it all gets swept away and you have to start again. So I thought the analogy was quite good. This is the density of air traffic in Europe. There's a considerable pressure on airspace capacity, and the pressure is large and it's continuing to increase. Even with the latest economic recession, there's been just a slight dip in traffic. But the forecasts are that between 2005 and 2030, the UK passenger demand is going to double. So that's a massive increase in requirement. Now, the European Aviation Safety Agency is the European body that's been set up to oversee safety regulation for civil aviation in Europe. Aviation was just about the only industry that hadn't been brought under the control of Europe. And so there was a political decision in the 1990s to reverse that and to bring aviation also under European, Central European control. Initially, the European Aviation Safety Agency, known as EASA, was set up in Brussels, but after a few months, it moved to Cologne in Western Germany. So why do we need European aviation rules? Well, the main theme is to remove barriers. So the focus is on removing the barriers to freedom of movement and freedom of trade, with the principle of fairness and equity for European citizens. And clearly, in the aviation environment, safety is absolutely paramount. EASA was created to develop the specific rules in different areas of civil aviation and to achieve a common high safety standard in those areas. It was also created to ensure economic harmonisation and to ensure that there was standardisation across the whole of the EU. And a very important point was that it provides the legal framework, because with the joint aviation requirements, which is the medical rules that are used in civil aviation at the moment, there is no legal framework for those requirements. So initially it was airworthiness that was captured by EASA, and the rules for airworthiness were developed really very early on in EASA's foundation. And those rules were brought into force in 2003, and I'm sure a lot of that was speeded up really because of the Airbus A380. The adoption of the rules for medical is going to go hand in hand with those for licensing and operations, and they're due to come into force in 2012, followed shortly thereafter by rules on air traffic management and air navigation services, which will include medical rules for air traffic control officers. So where is Europe? It's quite a question. Apparently there are 47 countries in Europe, but there's a constantly changing environment within Europe. People refer to Northern Europe and Southern Europe and Eastern and Western Europe, but there are no exact boundaries for those areas. There are also changes of internal borders, as we've seen in the Balkans. The atlas that I've got at home from my school days is vastly different to the one that my son uses now, in terms of the internal borders. And there's also external borders to think about. So there's Turkey, which is down here. There's a little bit of Turkey in Europe, and there's a large bit of Turkey, officially in Asia. Obviously, the Dardanelles run through Turkey. But Turkey has applied to become a member of the European Union. This is the European Union as it is now. There are 27 states. So out of the 47 states in Europe, 27 of those are in the European Union. There are four states associated with EASA. So they've signed an agreement with EASA, so they take on board the same rules, that aren't within the EU. And those four states are Norway, Iceland, Switzerland, and Liechtenstein. So why do we need a European Union? Well, without doubt, the move to create a European Union was driven by the two bloodiest wars that this planet has ever seen in the first half of the last century. The EU was first proposed in 1950. And it was founded with six member states, all in Western Europe. So Belgium, France, Germany, Italy, Luxembourg, and the Netherlands. Now for the...
From across the globe. From the centre of aerospace. And now to you.
Welcome to the Named Lecture Series on the Aero Society Channel. Brought to you by the Royal Aeronautical Society in association with IPA Media. For the usage policy of this and all other content on the Aero Society channel, please review the terms and conditions at aerosocietychannel.com.
Fellow DGs, trustees, ladies and gentlemen, as Chairman of the Board of Trustees for the Stuart Memorial Trust and DGMS REF, and on behalf of Ladies Matthews, who sadly cannot be with us here this evening, and Callum Stewart, welcome you to the 2010 Stuart Memorial Lecture. Before I move on to say a few words about Air Vice Marshal William Stewart and this evening's speaker, Sally Evans, can I offer the Trust's appreciation to the Royal Aeronautical Society and Martin Baker Aircraft Company Limited for their continuing support of the Stuart Memorial Lecture. Sally and I have spoken already and I know that she will refer to the life and works of Air Vice Marshal William Stewart, but I would like to take this opportunity to reinforce the significance of his life's work and hence the importance of this lecture. It's no exaggeration to say that the early death of Air Vice Marshal Stewart at the age of 53,
you're listening to the
medical services
lecture
lost
series,
one of its most illustrious officers.
The Royal Aeronautical Society,
the catalogue of his scientific and personal achievements,
we hope you are
is too
enjoying
long
the presentation.
To list. But it is safe to say he was a remarkable scientist who conducted his work with both courage and adventure. He dedicated his career to the study of the physiology of flight. to challenge the raft of limitations in order to advance the science of aviation medicine and ultimately to ensure the safety of aviators. Of equal importance was his charm and strength of character, and he was regarded by many as both a friend and a counsel. Air Vice Marshal William Stewart's many contributions to the science of aviation medicine continue to influence to this day and will do so for many years to come. And now to our speaker. Dr. Sally Evans worked as a general practitioner and for British Airways before joining the UK Civil Aviation Authority in 1993. She was appointed their chief medical officer in August 2005. She has and continues to have a significant role in aviation medicine. Amongst her many areas of expertise and influence are having been the UK representative on the Joint Aviation Authority's medical subgroup and the chairman of EASA's medical subgroup that drafted Class 1 and Class 2 medical recommendations. She is the medical representative on EASA's Flight Crew Licensing Core Group and is a member of the International Civil Aviation Organization's Medical Provisions Study Group. Furthermore, she is Deputy Chief Examiner for the UK Diploma in Aviation Medicine and is currently Chairman of the European Aviation Authority's Chief Medical Officers Forum. She also is held in a PPL. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm delighted to introduce Dr. Sally Evans.
Good evening, everyone. I'd very much like to thank the Chair of the Stewart Trustees, Air Vice Marshal Chris Morris, the Stewart Trustees, and the Chair of the Aerospace Medicine Committee of the Royal Aeronautical Society, Wing Commander Nick Green, for inviting me to speak to you this evening. As you know, the lecture is dedicated to the memory of Air Vice Marshal William Stewart. Now, Air Vice Marshal William Stewart was he was a student in Cambridge immediately before the last World War. He joined the RAF Voluntary Reserve and he was then called up and posted to a balloon unit in Northumberland. There he was found by Brian Matthews and brought down to Farnborough, from whence he led the acceleration research programme, and that continued during the war. He was the first head of the Institute of Aviation Medicine from 1946 through to his untimely death in 1967. Now, I was speaking with Frank Marshall at the AME conference on Saturday, and Frank told me that his most vivid memory of Bill Stewart was of him covered with blood, having bailed out of a Spitfire in a wind tunnel at Farnborough and landing on concrete. So those were the days before health and safety got in the way, very definitely. So this was the centrifuge that Bill Stewart would have known. And this was the centrifuge that I had a few runs in at Farnborough during my diploma course in 1995. Can you spot the difference? It is the same centrifuge. The bit that was added was the little cabin at the front here. So thank you very much, Nick, for providing those photos to me. Now, amongst this audience, quite a few of you will have had a few runs on the centrifuge. Can I just have a show of hands as to how many of you have been on the centrifuge? That's a fair number. That's a fair number. Okay. So there are a few that haven't, and there are a couple of points about the centrifuge that you need to know. To go on the centrifuge and to achieve the high G, you need to learn the anti-G straining manoeuvre. Now, this was taught to me during my diploma course, and hopefully the recent diploma course are well-versed in this and will remember it from very recent memory, I understand. And it's quite a noisy manoeuvre to perform. Now, many of you will know Mark Lewis, and Mark Lewis was in control of my centrifuge runs. His description of me was sounding like a hippopotamus in labour. most ungentlemanly, I think. The other point about the centrifuge is that it has effects on your facial features. It distorts the way that you look. And it makes you age by about 30 years. I've got a little video of me at home, which I didn't put onto the presentation. But I was given a video by Mark Lewis after my centrifuge runs, and I took it home to my children. Their description of me was that I turned into a witch. So So these are the type of facial distortions that you see. These pictures are all off YouTube. They're USAF pictures. So if any of the recent students have got pictures to upload, please put them on. Can have the most amazing effects. So I kind of wish I was a witch for this lecture, because I need a crystal ball. Talking about Europe and medical rules being developed within Europe is a bit of crystal ball gazing at the moment, as the rules are work in progress. We haven't achieved the final text, so I can't tell you any detail of the medical requirements that are to come. I called the lecture Untangling the Web, and that's because it's a very, very complex process. European legislation is really quite complicated. And also, just when you think you've got somewhere and you've built up a big structure, it all gets swept away and you have to start again. So I thought the analogy was quite good. This is the density of air traffic in Europe. There's a considerable pressure on airspace capacity, and the pressure is large and it's continuing to increase. Even with the latest economic recession, there's been just a slight dip in traffic. But the forecasts are that between 2005 and 2030, the UK passenger demand is going to double. So that's a massive increase in requirement. Now, the European Aviation Safety Agency is the European body that's been set up to oversee safety regulation for civil aviation in Europe. Aviation was just about the only industry that hadn't been brought under the control of Europe. And so there was a political decision in the 1990s to reverse that and to bring aviation also under European, Central European control. Initially, the European Aviation Safety Agency, known as EASA, was set up in Brussels, but after a few months, it moved to Cologne in Western Germany. So why do we need European aviation rules? Well, the main theme is to remove barriers. So the focus is on removing the barriers to freedom of movement and freedom of trade, with the principle of fairness and equity for European citizens. And clearly, in the aviation environment, safety is absolutely paramount. EASA was created to develop the specific rules in different areas of civil aviation and to achieve a common high safety standard in those areas. It was also created to ensure economic harmonisation and to ensure that there was standardisation across the whole of the EU. And a very important point was that it provides the legal framework, because with the joint aviation requirements, which is the medical rules that are used in civil aviation at the moment, there is no legal framework for those requirements. So initially, it was airworthiness that was captured by EASA, and the rules for airworthiness were developed really very early on in EASA's foundation. And those rules were brought into force in 2003, and I'm sure a lot of that was speeded up really because of the Airbus A380. The adoption of the rules for medical is going to go hand in hand with those for licensing and operations, and they're due to come into force in 2012, followed shortly thereafter by rules on air traffic management and air navigation services, which will include medical rules for air traffic control officers. So where is Europe? It's quite a question. Apparently there are 47 countries in Europe. But there's a constantly changing environment within Europe. People refer to Northern Europe and Southern Europe and Eastern and Western Europe, but there are no exact boundaries for those areas. There are also changes of internal borders, as we've seen in the Balkans. The atlas that I've got at home from my school days is vastly different to the one that my son uses now in terms of the internal borders. And there's also external borders to think about. So there's Turkey, which is down here. There's a little bit of Turkey in Europe, and there's a large bit of Turkey officially in Asia. Obviously, the Dardanelles run through Turkey. But Turkey has applied to become a member of the European Union. This is the the European Union as it is now. There are 27 states. So out of the 47 states in Europe, 27 of those are in the European Union. There are four states associated with the EASA, so they've signed an agreement with the EASA, so they take on board the same rules, that aren't within the EU. And those four states are Norway, Iceland, Switzerland, and Liechtenstein. So why do we need a European Union? Well, without doubt, the move to create a European Union was driven by the two bloodiest wars that this planet has ever seen in the first half of the last century. The EU was first proposed in 1950, and it was founded with six member states, all in Western Europe. So Belgium, France, Germany, Italy, Luxembourg, and the Netherlands. Now, for the foundation speech, this was made by a chap called Robert Schuman. I don't know how many of you will have heard of Schuman. Probably those of you that lived in Germany will have heard of him, because there's a bank holiday in Germany called Schuman Day. Now, I didn't know this existed until I happened to be in Germany on one of my visits to EASA on the 9th of May. And I was amazed that it was a bank holiday. I thought they got it wrong, because in France, the 8th of May is a bank holiday, which is Victory in Europe Day. I think this was the decision was made to create a day for Europe on purpose, the day after VE Day. I can't believe that that was a coincidence. And this is now described as the birthday of the European Union. And I have seen it recently described as Europe Day. So this is becoming a more frequently used bank holiday within Europe. Robert Schuman was the French foreign minister at the time, and his aim was to create political and economic harmonisation. The first body of the EU that was set up was the European Coal and Steel Community, and without doubt, the reason that the coal and steel industry was targeted was because it was that industry that produced the weapons of war. The Treaty of Rome, which probably most of you will have heard about, was signed later on in the 50s, and that created the European Economic Community, later to be known as the Common Market, and even later on known just simply as the European Community. So in 1973, three more countries joined. That included the UK, together with Denmark and Ireland. Greece was the 10th country to join in 1981. And there was a definite move at that point in time to shift economies and money towards areas where there was need. So poorer countries that needed economic help would be specifically targeted by the European Union. And that's continued to this day. And the essential point there is to maintain the stability. They wanted to maintain the economic levels at a harmonised level so that there would not be social unrest. It was a definite move. Now, Portugal and Spain both had right-wing dictatorships until the 1970s. The Salazar regime in Portugal was overthrown in 1974, and the General Franco died in 1975. So clearly there was again a political shift, and that enabled those two countries, Portugal and Spain, to join in 1986. Another concept that you've probably heard about is the single market. And there are four freedoms that are inherent to the single market. That's movement of goods, services, people and money. That's often referred to. And three more countries joined in 1995. Now we get to the collapse of communism in the early 1990s. Which again, after a 10 to 15 year period, which is the sort of time frame that's usually required before countries have a complete shift in policies, there was a huge expansion with the Central and Eastern European countries being brought in. And that gives rise to the current total of 27. Now, I mentioned earlier that Turkey is a candidate country. There are other candidate countries, so Croatia and Macedonia are the other candidate countries at the moment. And many of the other Balkan states are potential candidate countries. And I'll come back to the further expansion later on. I'm just going to say just a few words about the Treaty of Lisbon, which came into force on the 1st of December last year. Now, you've probably listened to the news. I don't know about you, but I got very confused about what the Treaty of Lisbon was all about. There were a few tweaks around the edges. So there was a little bit of terminology changing. So the European Community became the European Union. The common market went back to being called an internal market. And a few of the competencies or responsibilities changed. So the EU is now responsible for climate change issues, environment, R&D and innovation. And there were also a few changes to people, and these are the ones that got the publicity and the news. So most of you will recognise the chap on the top right there. That's Herman Van Rompuy, who's a Belgian, who has taken over as the president of the European Council. Now, his job is to achieve consensus. It's more an administrative post than anything else. He hasn't got any executive powers, and he hasn't got any legislative powers. And the lady at the bottom there is Baroness Catherine Ashton, who was a UK commissioner, and she was appointed essentially as the Foreign Affairs Minister. She's responsible for proposals for security and defence measures, and also for setting up a diplomatic network around the world. So that might be the bit of the Treaty of Lisbon that you actually heard about. This is what's really important, is the legal changes behind the Lisbon Treaty. And the reason I'm mentioning it here is because this is really important for the medical requirements. There are changes to the legislative processes within Europe that have come in. The jurisdiction of the courts has been widened to cover almost all the EU activities. And importantly, the European Parliament has had an extension of its powers. You might have previously heard about the three pillars. There's the single market, the home affairs and justice, and foreign pillars. And those have all been merged. So that whole concept is now gone, if you've heard about that previously. And very importantly, the EU now has legal personality in terms of international law. So the two really important points, and the points that are going to affect us, is that the European Parliament has had its powers widened, and that means it now has more direct legislative powers, and that is going to affect medical rulemaking. And the EU has now got a legal personality of its own. That's really important. Probably wonder why on earth I'm going with all this politics. It really is fundamental to the way that the rules are being developed in Europe, and you need to know a little bit about it to understand where the process is headed off to. The EU regulatory system essentially has got three main bodies. So there are three main institutions. There's the Parliament, which is responsible, really the representative of all the citizens in Europe. The Council, which has the representatives of the national governments. And then there's the Commission, which I've called the civil service, but it really represents the sort of EU as a whole. So those are the three main bodies. So the European Parliament sits in Brussels and Strasbourg, and you may be aware that they sit for Brussels in 3 weeks and they all troop down to Strasbourg for a week. And then they've also got an office in Luxembourg. So it's quite an effort. They've got 736 members, of which 72 at the moment are UK members. Now, you may remember a ballot sheet a bit like that last year, endless numbers of potential candidates for MEPs. I think this was June last year we had the elections for the MEPs. And I've listed on the left there the parties within the UK that have now got representatives in the European Parliament. But they don't sit according to state. So they don't sit all the English in one place and all the French in another. They develop political affiliations, and then they sit according to those affiliated groups. That's how they work. The Lisbon Treaty has made a slight difference to the numbers, which is why it's going up to 73 fairly shortly. So as well as the Parliament, there's the Council. The Council used to be called the Council of Ministers. It's now called the Council of the EU. But it's easier to remember if it's Council of Ministers, really, because this is where the ministers get together. They decide the high-level strategy and the overall direction for the EU. And they have a number of working groups that are set up to provide them with all the detailed work. But they make the detailed decisions about where we're headed. The Aviation Working Group was a group that I attended when the medical rules were being developed. And essentially what happens there is the president at the time, i.e. a representative of whichever country holds the presidency, controls the whole meeting. And it's their job to achieve compromise within the group, which can really be quite difficult. There are loads of councils in Europe. It gets really, really confusing. The important one is that one, the Council of Ministers or Council of the EU. You'll also hear the European Council, and that's the summits. So when Gordon Brown goes off for a summit, that's what he's attending, is the European Council. That happens about once every 6 months or so. There's also the Council of Europe, which has been a bit notorious recently for dinner parties, I think. The aim of the Council of Europe is the protection of human rights. It's to uphold democracy, to counter xenophobia, to prevent social unrest, and promote diversity. So that's the essential role of the Council of Europe. It's not an EU body, and all 47 states in Europe are represented in the Council of Europe, so it's a completely different body. The European Commission is the bit that I referred to as the civil service. You'll all recognise the guy at the top here. The president is José Manuel Barroso, who's a Portuguese chap. And the presidency of the Commission is held for 5 years with a renewable term. The man at the bottom there is a chap called Siim Kallas, and he used to be the Estonian Prime Minister. He's now in charge of the whole of transport for the European Commission. It's an immensely powerful role. So the President of the Commission appoints commissioners for different areas of policy. They all have their own portfolios. And our Directorate General, the one that we used to liaise with, used to be called DG TREN. So a lot of you will have heard the expression DG TREN, which was the Directorate General for the Environment and Transport. But the Environment has kind of upped in importance and now has its own directorate. So that's moved off. And somebody thought of this snappily titled DG MOVE. So the Directorate General of Mobility and Transport is now called DG MOVE. And essentially that has the role that the Commission has. So it's policy making, it's oversight and enforcement. That's what the Commission's all about. So, eventually, we get to the medical rules. So, these EC regulations that have been brought in or are being brought in are to do with these different areas of policy making in civil aviation. The airworthiness one, as I explained, was the very earliest one that came in. And that was known as the basic regulation until 2008, when the medical, the licensing and the operational rules also came in. Then that was called the basic regulation. And that included what they termed the first extension. Then they created another one. So air traffic management then became the latest regulation, then that was called the basic regulation. So it gets terribly confusing. But when I refer to the basic regulation, I'm talking about the medical licensing and ops one, because that's where all the high-level rules for medical sit. So what's not known by a lot of people is that the basic regulation for the medical rules is European law now. It's already in. It's the implementing rules, which are the more detailed rules which attach to the basic regulation, which are being developed at the moment. And I'll go on to talk about those. There are also sets of non-binding rules. Now, non-binding doesn't mean you have to comply with them. You still have to comply with them. And they're known as acceptable means of compliance and guidance material. But this isn't as important because EASA is able to accept or reject rules of this level. So that doesn't have to go through this massive European legislative process. It's just the basic regulation and the implementing rules that need to be dealt with at a commission level. I thought it was worth just mentioning how many medical certificates are issued every year across the European Union. These are just European Union figures. The JARA, the Joint Aviation Requirements, which are the current rules in force. And at the moment, there's just over 150,000 per year Class 1 certificates that are issued, and about 185,000 Class 2. There are also an unknown number of national certificates. Quite a few countries still have national certification despite the JAR being brought in. What's going to happen under EASA? There are additional categories being brought in. So balloons and gliders and airships are being brought into the EASA rules, and at the moment they're all dealt with nationally. So that's going to be a change. So this basic regulation is really very simple in terms of the rules. Essentially, the pilots have to be fit. They have to have a periodic assessment for their medical fitness. AMEs have to be qualified, and they have to have had practical experience of aviation. And aeromedical centres, which is where the initial Class 1s are done, have to have adequate staff, appropriately trained, and appropriate facilities. So it's quite high level. Now, just to emphasise the difference between EASA and the National Aviation Authority, I think a lot of people were concerned that the whole of the regulation was moving over to Europe. Well, the day-to-day work is still going to happen in the individual states. So EASA is going to be responsible for the policy making. It's going to be responsible for overseeing the national authorities and for enforcing it. And one of the means of enforcing it will be by standardising the different states. But it will be the national aviation authorities that are still responsible for the day-to-day medical certification in all of the states and will also be responsible for appeals. Now, I mentioned the development of the medical requirements and the fact that the basic regulation is already in. That was brought in April 2008. It was actually quite difficult because we were working on drafting the rules for Class 1 and Class 2 medical requirements right up to about February 2008. So we needed to know what was going to be in the basic regulation in order to attach those medical rules to them. So they were being worked on in parallel. Now, there was a licensing core group that was set up to deal with the overall rules for licensing and medical. And they had four subgroups. The groups dealt with what the national aviation authorities needed to do, with the JAR certification, so class one and class two essentially, and then all the licenses that had not previously been dealt with under JAR. And then there was the medical subgroup as well. Now, it was a time of really intense activity trying to write these Class 1 and Class 2 requirements. We're currently looking at the rules that EASA have proposed. EASA produced a document later on in 2008, and that was sent out for public consultation, and many of you I know here responded to that consultation. EASA have set up a group to look at the responses that were sent in as a result of the consultation. And I've been part of the group looking at those responses. And in fact, I was at a meeting just a couple of weeks ago, this was a picture taken only two weeks ago, looking at the responses to the Class 1 and the Class 2 requirements. And Robert Hunter, as we speak, is over in EASA dealing with the LAPL, the Light Aircraft Pilot Licence proposals. That's what I would have preferred to have been. Now, there were 2,300 comments on the medical proposals, absolutely vast number of comments. And as you would expect from pilots and from medics, they were very detailed comments. Justification was requested by EASA, and a lot of people have clearly put a huge amount of effort and thought into replying. About half the comments were on the lighter end, so the light aircraft pilot's license proposals, but about half were on Class 1 and Class 2. But just a very few of the comments reminded me of a quote. Now, the chap in this picture is Henry Tilney, who is the hero in Jane Austen's Northanger Abbey, and this was a production that I saw on ITV a couple of years ago. And Henry Tilney came up with this line. Well, for those of you that can't read it, I will read it out for those that can't read. I've always found that ignorance and prejudice hold no bar to forming the strongest of opinions. Only a few were like that. It was interesting to look at the attitudes that were behind some of the comments that came through. We're all so influenced by our own experience. What we've experienced is the norm. Everybody else has cultural differences. And it was also clear that new ideas, innovative ideas, were quite difficult to accept. And they tended to be viewed negatively. Very interesting. This is just human psyche. It was important for us to look at all the comments and consider them as individual comments. Now, a decision was made very, very early on for the joint aviation requirements to form the basis for the Class 1 rules. I think the people that did the work in the early 1990s, which included Ken Edgington and Ron Pearson from the UKCAA, and Michael Joy as well, really did a phenomenal amount of work in trying to get consensus through Europe. It must have been the most enormously difficult task, because I could see how difficult it was really with the basis already in place, or the responses that we looked at. But there was also a decision to move away from JAL FCL Class 2 requirements for private pilots and put that more towards the ICAO rules so that the standard was lower, because everyone felt, and there really was a unanimous feeling, that the rules had been set too high. And what had happened was that individual nations had voted with their feet and they had maintained their national licenses to get around it. It also became apparent that a number of states had not actually implemented the latest amendment. So Amendment 5 is the latest amendment of JAR, but only 20 states out of the 37 Joint Aviation Requirements states had actually implemented those rules. So the basis that we had in the drafting group was to stick to JAR FCL 3 Class 1, use ICAO, and also we had to adhere to the basic regulation, except for the light aircraft pilot's license. Now, many of you may have heard of the recreational pilot's license, the European private pilot's license, the leisure pilot's license, and the light aircraft pilot's license. I think that was probably the second proposal, but it's come back to that now. That's what it's going to be called. And that we are allowed to have as a sub-ICAO medical certificate. The concept was that the assessment for a LAPL certificate could be general practitioner based. And there were several models in Europe for this. There was the UK National Private Pilot's License, but there were also models in France, the Brevet de Base, and in Switzerland as well. We wanted just a history based medical declaration, but it soon became clear that there had to be some form of examination, even to a sort of minimal level. But it was allowed to be sub-ICAO. Now, the MPA comments, as I hinted at earlier, were really what Robert describes as bimodal. They were either totally against or totally for. But the ones that were totally against were either totally against because they thought it was too liberal, or totally against because they thought it was too strict. So it really was interesting. And I don't know how they're getting on this week, but I wish Robert luck with that. One decision that was made was that rotary wing flying would not be included within the LAPL. That was withdrawn at a fairly early stage. But there has been some redrafting of the LAPL proposals. Now, Napoleonic law is very interesting. Basically, according to the French, if nothing's in the rules, you can do nothing. The Napoleonic code. Roman law, on the other hand, if there's nothing in the rules, you can do anything. And that view came through in the comments that we got on the proposals. Amazing difference in the legislative frameworks for the different states in Europe. And it's about half-half. Another interesting point was the importance of language. I've just given a few examples here. We spent a long time, about 15, 20 minutes, talking about a license, and the French were talking about a licence. And we suddenly realised we were talking about different things because the French were talking about a valid license, not just a license. So their word for license is brevet. So it's completely different. And the word examen, French don't have a word for assessment. They translate ICAO assessment as examen, which in the French language is examination. And that's the reason that for the light aircraft pilot's license, we are stuck with having an examination. It cannot be translated any other way. European English. English, as with all languages, is dynamic. I mean, which of us here will have heard of a staycation 2 years ago? But now it's the thing to do. If you ask my 8-year-old what a mouse is, I haven't got one here, but he'll say it's something to do with a computer. He won't, as his first thought, think of the little animal that scurries across the floor. The word competence I mentioned earlier on. In European English, that means responsibility. It doesn't mean you're competent to do something. It means that you're responsible for it. And the word intact causes great grievance as well. There's a phrase that you will see, because I don't think I managed to get rid of it, that describes an intact left ventricle. That means a functioning and working left ventricle, according to everybody else but me. And I explained the fact that an intact left ventricle was pretty essential for life. But I couldn't get the concept across at all. So anyway, so we have that phrase, unfortunately, kept left in. There are lots of acronyms in Europe. The acronym CoREPAIR, which I used to call CoReaper, which sounds like a stalker, is one of the few. And a lot of the acronyms are based on the French the French language. So CoREPAIR actually is the Committee of Permanent Representatives. It just doesn't make sense when you twist the acronyms around. But it's amazing how many times during just the 1 week of review group discussions we came across issues where we had different concepts because of the translation of the languages. There are also essential differences in medical training. Now, these were two interesting facts that I didn't know before the review group meeting. The picture of the ophthalmoscope. Well, if you train as a doctor in Belgium, you don't know how to use an ophthalmoscope. You are never taught to look through an ophthalmoscope. And the only people that use ophthalmoscopes are people that choose to undertake postgraduate courses in ophthalmology. So the general practitioners will not be taught how to use an ophthalmoscope. So when you talk about all the eye rules, they can't understand how an AME can examine eyes. It's really, really different. The picture of the exercise test on the right-hand side is to inform you that the Germans, when they qualify, consider that they are perfectly competent, using the English language use of the word, to report on exercise tests. That's part of their training. They are taught it as part of their training, and they consider that even as a newly qualified foundation year houseman, they are competent to report on them. So again, when I said, well, I'm not sure that our AMEs are able to report on exercise tests, they couldn't understand that at all. So there are really quite major differences in medical training. Now, there are some big issues for individual states, and I've just pointed out a few of them here. For Germany, Germany is divided into Bundesländer, which is really sort of federal states within Germany. These regional authorities each designate an aeromedical centre. So Germany has more than 26 aeromedical centres. There are huge controls in Germany about data transfer. This was brought in as part of the post-war legislation, essentially to ensure that there was no build-up of data or misuse of personal data. And that's the other reason that the Bundesländer were brought in as well. So it was always, you know, they're very much subject to the post-war legislation. And an interesting fact which arose was that in Germany, you are able to make, quite legally, a false declaration. Now, this is staggering to me, but there is prevailing case law where if you declare an item of your medical history, that's absolutely fine. If you decide that you don't want to declare it, if by declaring it you would disadvantage yourself, you are allowed to do that. So it's a very different approach, but there is prevailing case law, and it is of the highest court in the land as well. So there are potentially going to have to be some changes at the EU level to deal with those aspects. Now, in France, it's just that the system's very different in France. There aren't class one AMEs all around France. There are five aeromedical centres, most of them are mixed military-civil, and they undertake all class one exams, so they don't undertake just the initial class ones. They do all the revalidation and the expired as well. All the referrals to the National Aviation Authority, the DGAC, are discussed by a committee, the Conseil d'État. And there are 1,000 Class 2 aeromedical examiners who are scattered all over France. So it's just a very, very different setup. In the UK, our major issues are to do with the National Private Pilot's Licence, because it's a system that we've had established here now for the last 7 years and really does work well. And we were very keen to support general aviation in not increasing the rules too drastically. And cabin crew. We have a different system compared to many states in Europe, and we don't have Class 2 certification for cabin crew, which about half the states in Europe have. Now, all states have an issue with wanting some form of database to cover the whole of Europe. Because at the moment, if the medical information is going into a central authority, you can keep a control on your pilots. If there isn't a central unfit database, we're a bit concerned that a pilot could go to one state, declare medical history, be refused a medical certificate, and then go to another state and decide not to declare. And there would be no way of us knowing that they've transferred states. We just have to maintain a sort of watching brief so that if a Lithuanian pilot who lives in Latvia decides to come to the UK for his medical, but he actually wants to do his training elsewhere, we'd ask why. So it's not totally satisfactory. Auditing requirements. Potentially the auditing requirements could be quite onerous. And that's because the rules have been developed on the type of auditing that surveyors do. So inspection of an office is the type of auditing that has been written into the rules. And we explained to the European Commission lawyers that the type of auditing we want to do is about decisions. We're interested in how good an AME is at making decisions, not about whether their office is pristine. Grandfather rights, an issue for everybody who holds a medical certificate. Clearly there will be some rules that come in that will make current holders of certificates unfit, potentially. And we want to ensure that everybody is able to maintain their current privileges, so that's a big issue for everybody. And how we update the requirements, I think that is being sorted out gradually, but it's a process that will evolve as these rules are written. Now, there are considerable historical and geographical allegiances in Europe, and that was clear in some of the responses that we received, and that's absolutely inevitable, really. I've put two examples of the Scandinavian countries and the Baltic states, who tend to have very similar views. Cabin crew medical assessment. I was just going to mention cabin crew. In the proposals, the EASA proposals, there will be an attestation, which is in all but name a license for the cabin crew. It's going to be named an attestation. And there will also be a medical certificate for cabin crew. What we're very keen to ensure is that the medical rules are kept as low as possible so that industry is not disadvantaged, because economically this could have a drastic effect. As I mentioned earlier, about half the states in Europe follow Class 2 rules at cabin crew at the moment, and half two have operator-led medical assessment for cabin crew. ATCO medical requirements are going to come in at some stage. They're not in the current drafting rules, but Eurocontrol is taking the lead. There is a directive at the moment which deals with ATCO medical requirements, but a directive has to be put into national law. It's not direct and not directly applicable like a regulation is. So during the next year or so, EASA will be setting up a group to look at ATCO medical requirements to bring them under the part medical that's being developed. So that's for the future. A word about third country medical certification. This doesn't mean third world country. That's what people think of it as. Third country means anyone outside the EU. The approval of either an AME or an aeromedical centre is going to be according to principal place of business. So if you work for 3 days in one state, 2 days in another, it'll be the first state that oversees your approval. If aeromedical centres are set up outside the EU, EASA will have very direct oversight of them. We think at the moment, aeromedical examiners that are situated outside the EU will have their approval overseen by an individual EU state, but it's not sure yet. There's going to be a third country operator's proposal for amendment in December. It's due to be published. And we'll see then what exactly the proposals are. But again, there are distinct differences even within the states at the moment. So the UK has overseas territories and crown dependencies. Now, the overseas territories are places like Bermuda, Falklands, Gibraltar, Turks and Caicos, places like that. Crown dependencies are Jersey, Guernsey, Isle of Man. So they're outside the EU. Now, France has overseas departments and territories, such as Guadeloupe, Martinique, Réunion. They're considered part of France, so they're not outside the EU. So again, there are these subtle differences in the way that we're set up. Now, there will be certain aircraft that are outside EASA's competence or responsibility. They're known as Annex 2 aircraft because they're described in Annex 2, the basic regulation. And these include historic aircraft, military aircraft, gyroplanes and microlights. So EASA is not going to be responsible for pilots flying those aircraft, nor is it going to be responsible for flight engineers or flight navigators. And there are going to be no medical rules created under EASA for these personnel. So where we've reached at the moment is the responses that have been put in to EASA as a result of the consultation that went out are being looked at. And what EASA are doing for Class 1 and Class 2 proposals and for the light aircraft pilot licence, they're looking at each and every response and they're deciding whether they accept that response, partially accept it, don't accept it at all, or they're just noting it. And they're going to provide that sort of comment against each of the comments that have been put in. So that's 2,300 comments. That's a lot of comments. They're going to handle the cabin crew responses differently, apparently. What they intend to do is to summarise all the comments and then describe how EASA are dealing with that group of comments. So that's going to be dealt with differently. Now, we're hoping that for all these areas, we will have a revised text, because really the only way we can look at the comment response document when it's published by EASA is to look at revised text, because it's all very well going to your own comment and checking that you've got the right response, but if somebody else has put something in and they've actually changed the text as a result, you need to be wary of that. But what EASA has said is that they will give everyone a further 2-month period during which you can comment to EASA, but you are only allowed to comment if you think that EASA have misinterpreted what you were trying to say. So if you want to put in another comment or proposal, they're not going to respond to that. And what happens after that is that EASA send what they call their opinion, i.e. their proposal for the implementing rules, through to the Commission. And that's where it gets complicated, and that's why I needed to tell you about the Lisbon Treaty and the politics. It's really unclear quite what happens. It used to be that it would just go to the Commission, that the lawyers in the Commission would tweak it slightly and give it back to EASA as the final text. But now, because of this shift of power to the Parliament slightly, the sort of increased legal teeth that the EU's got, there's a comitology, and I think there's also a co-decision process, but they usually refer to it as comitology. Co-decision is when the Council and the Parliament decide jointly. But comitology really is an abstract concept. And I actually asked one of the European Commission lawyers quite what was going to happen, and they didn't know. So, don't know. We don't know how long it's going to take either. They absolutely have to get this in force by April 2012, but we just don't know how long it's going to take. It's going to take the most enormous number of meetings, enormous amount of coffee drinking, and there we are. April 2012 is the drop dead date. We have to have the rules in. Legally, they have to be there. So they have to be adopted on that date. Now, everyone's realised, because it's drifted forward and it's taken quite a while to produce these implementing rules, and we know now that it's going to take a little longer than we anticipated, there is going to be a transition period. We don't, at the moment, know how long that transition period is going to be. It's likely to be a couple of years, but as I say, we just don't know at the moment. So where are we going beyond that? Well, there certainly will be future developments. The European Common Aviation Area tends to be the bit of Europe to the east and the Balkan states. That's the way that it is described. And there are states both within the ECAA and outside it with which EASA has been holding discussions. So there have certainly been missions, they call them, to Moldova, Georgia, Azerbaijan, and Armenia. So those are the immediate states with which EASA is going to create a relationship. And presumably at some stage in the future, these states may come on board in terms of either the European Union or certainly become EASA associated states. So as I mentioned earlier, changing borders really are changing here. So EASA has had a really steep learning curve. I mean, it was only set up in 2003, and it's really done the most enormous amount of work from scratch since it was created. It's had to involve all the stakeholders, so it's involved industry and it's involved the aviation authorities, and really it's developed good working partnerships. It took a little while to start, but the working partnerships that have now been developed have been very, very helpful indeed. Everyone's goal is aviation safety at the end of the day. And the way forward has to be increasing cooperation, both within Europe and on the borders of Europe and more widely. So with the FAA, with other major regulators, and with ICAO. And harmonisation at the end of the day is what we need to achieve. And I think that's the way that we will be going in the future. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Named Lecture Series. Find more from this series and other events at aerosocietychannel.com. Involved in aviation and aerospace? Royal Aeronautical Society corporate partner members enjoy involvement and access to the work of the Society, together with an excellent range of benefits, including superb networking opportunities. Membership signifies an organization's commitment to best practice in the international aerospace community, irrespective of the size of the operation. See www.aerosociety.com to find out more or to get in touch. This presentation was brought to you by the Royal Aeronautical Society in association with IPA Media. For the usage policy of this and all other content on the Aero Society channel, please review the terms and conditions at aerosocietychannel.com.